1948, after the war, is that we see two Jerusalems. Now, the western part of Jerusalem is a fairly big city, but still it's not huge. It's about the same as the municipality of Tel Aviv. We're talking about 50 square kilometers, and that would be the city up until 1967. And Israel invests a lot in the western part of Jerusalem in order to make sure that people understand that's going to be the capital, and since what internationally it wasn't supposed to be the capital. It was supposed to be an international city under the UN resolution from 1947. So Israel invests a lot in West Jerusalem, from the parliament to Supreme Court, President's home, you know, making it kind of a cultural center and the capital. And the Jordanians, at the same time, they used the eastern part of Jerusalem as their secondary capital from the 1960s, but it's not a big city. It's about 6 square kilometers. So take the old city, add a bit to the north, to the south, what we call the historic basin of Jerusalem. So it leads down to Silwan and up to Sheikh Jarrah and east to the Mount of Olives, but yet it's a very small city. And that's home of a couple of thousands or tens of thousands of Palestinians up until 67. But what the annexation would do in 1967 in order to ensure a Jewish majority in Jerusalem, or to assure lines that will be able to protect Israel in case it would be needed, then Israel stretches the eastern part of Jerusalem and makes it into a monster. And from 6 square kilometers, which is a Jordanian city, now we're talking about 70. So that's times 12. And that means that many Palestinian neighborhoods that were surrounding Jerusalem and never saw themselves as Jerusalemites are now residents of Israel, are now Jerusalemites. So people living in Kfar Aqab in the north, which are much closer to Ramallah, they're now under the sovereignty of Israel, and they receive an Israeli residency because they're living on the way to the airport. That's, and Israel wants the airport. That's near Shoafat. Yeah. So Israel needs the airport, so it would take them and annex them because, you know, it's on the way and we need them. And on the way to the south, because Israel want to have the ridge of Gilo, where we're going right now, then Israel would annex areas like Tzur Ba'er and Tuba, which never saw themselves as Jerusalemites. Israel is the one to create that monster of Jerusalem. And now we're talking about a city of over 120 square kilometers. That's a huge city. So unlike any other city that's built because of urban development or natural flow of the city, Jerusalem is built over the political ideas. Once you annex and 25% of your capital is Palestinian, then what Israel is wanting to do for those years is to make sure it promises a Jewish majority in the city. And to do so, it needs to build huge Jewish neighborhoods. There was no demographic need at the time. It wasn't that people didn't have a place to live, so we had to build a new neighborhood. We build a neighborhood, and then we look for people to go live in those neighborhoods.
Now, we've crossed the green line.
We've crossed the green line just a couple of minutes ago, but then we went on the highway, so we're going to cross it again. We're doing a meander.
And the green line is a fiction. It doesn't exist. You could just, there's no sign that says,
no,
you're now crossing the green line.
There isn't. What happened in Jerusalem, and that is, I think, the most successful thing that happened on the eyes of the Israeli governments, I would assume, is that the green line was eroded in the city. And if back in the day the green line correspond with what is the border between Israel and Jordan, or the ceasefire line, since these are enemy countries for those years, what happens is that once the unification is done, Israel takes off that wall that used to cross the city. The city was like Berlin for many years, with a wall that crosses East and West Jerusalem. But after the war, the wall is taken off, and now you don't know where the green line is anymore. So we are now driving right on Begin Highway. And to both our right and left, we're going to see Beit Safafa, which is an interesting story. It's a Palestinian village that parts of it already became Israel in 1948, right? So those people became citizens of Israel. Very similar to the story in Jaffa, for example, or Haifa, those who stayed. And the others were living in Jordan. And the wall crossed pretty much in the middle of the village, you can say. What Israel did was to take off. That wall, and now it's impossible for you with your eyes to see which part of Beit Safafa is which. But having said that, we're crossing the green line right now as we're making the turn towards Gilo, and we're going to see one of the most important Israeli neighborhoods / settlements that were built post green line, post 1967. And nowadays, people enter East Jerusalem and they ask, are we in the West Bank? Well, technically, yes, of course, you're in the West Bank. That was a part of Jordan up until 67. But I have to say that in reality, in practicality, when you're living in East Jerusalem as an Israeli Jew in those homes in Gilo, you don't feel anything different than if you live in a Western neighborhood in Jerusalem. And on that level, the unification of Jerusalem worked for Israel. I don't think the Palestinians expect Israel to remove settlements like Gilo. This is 40,000 people or so living in it. We have 60,000 in Ramot. So the Green Line just became less of an issue in Jerusalem.
This is
Gilo all around us. You see, it's a nice neighborhood. It's not super expensive, but it's not very, very cheap anymore. It's a mediocre, I mean, in the size of it, and in the class of it, and in the cost of it. It used to be that people moved to Gilo because it was cheaper. That's not necessarily the case anymore. It's an okay neighborhood, nice even. So somebody moving to Gilo doesn't make a political statement that they're moving post the Green Line. We had people on Ir Amim tours that we told them about how Jerusalem was built, and then they told us, well, we live in Gilo, I live in Gilo for 40 years. I never knew I live on the other side of the Green Line. We can even go up on this here. I have bigger groups to go all the way down, but excuse me.
Oh.
Yeah. So we are in Gilo, and we are also in the outskirts of Jerusalem. Show on the map here. We made it all the way to what is the municipal line of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Now, post-annexation, which means already by the month of June 1967, the war is finished after 6 days, and Israel chooses to do something it doesn't do in any other place in the West Bank, and that is to annex a certain area to Israel. That means that from the moment annexation would be done, the Israeli law applies in all parts of East Jerusalem. And the question is, where is exactly the eastern part of Jerusalem going to be? So if we see the Old City as kind of the center of that map, the idea is to kind of protect the Old City, to make sure that it would exist, yeah, under Israel's land, but also to make sure that the city stretches to the mountain ridges that are all around it. And we have one in the east called Mount of Olives, we have one in the north called the Shofar Tree, and we have one in the south, which is the Gilo one. The idea is that Israel will be protected. And if at one case, in one day, perhaps the West Bank will be given or handed to the Jordanians or to the Palestinians, I think nobody knows in June of 1967 who it's going to be. But the idea is that the eastern part of Jerusalem would already pass kind of a change. And after the annexation is done, the idea is to build very big Israeli neighborhoods in order to be there. That gives Israel legitimacy to hold those neighborhoods. Some of them are bigger than many cities in Israel. Ramot, for example, is the biggest one, has 60,000 people. And all of them are, as I said, beyond the Green Line. All of them are settlements. All of them are without agreement of the international law, against the international law. But Israel sees a difference as well. We annex the area, so it's a part of the country. And most people move there, but not because of any ideological reasons, you know, just because it was a cheap area to go. And it feels very connected. So the Green Line, the way Israel sees it, doesn't exist anymore. And we're fighting for that idea, because we see the Green Line as critical in Jerusalem, in Ir Amim. And the best, I think, example we can have for that was going to be in Givat HaMatos. We're going to go there next and see how Israel tries to connect all the neighborhoods in order to make sure that the division of Jerusalem will not happen. And by the way, it could be that the division is not happening and it can't happen. And yet, we are fighting for very basic rights of the Palestinians who live in Jerusalem because they don't have them. So that would be it. So Gilo is a critical one because that is the one that will be built between Israel and between Beit Jala and Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. So if Beit Jala is just in front of us right now, we're talking about a Palestinian city now under the Palestinian Authority, what is stopping...
Nominally.
What is?
Nominally under the Palestinian
Nominally.
Authority.
Nominally.
The Israelis go in there anytime they want.
Obviously. But it's very easy for Israel that it doesn't have to take care of what's happening in Beit Jala. You know, when I used to do reserves in the Israeli army, and before Oslo, I mean, when we talked to the older guys in my platoon, they talked about how when there was a domestic abuse story, then the Israeli army had to go in to a Palestinian city. Now imagine, you know, it's in the middle of a very crowded neighborhood, and the Israeli army and police are, you know, they need to make their way in to stop a very local story. And that's not something that Israeli soldiers, I would assume, yeah, like doing. Now the Israelis have someone to do it. There's a Palestinian police. They take care of all those things that Israel just doesn't want to do. And yet, obviously, if Israel want to take anyone from areas A, B, or C in the West Bank, it does it. We've been seeing a lot of that actually happening in the last months in the refugee camp of Jenin. And now Bennett is giving his final interviews and he's very proud to say, oh, I've been sending troops every day to those areas. So, of course, Israel is the only real sovereign power here. And the Palestinian Authority is perhaps kind of a contractor that does, you know, collecting some taxes, sending some police, but it has no power in reality.
So why do organizations like Ir Amin oppose the erasure of the Green Line, the vanishing of the Green Line? Because I suspect for most ordinary Israelis, the Green Line doesn't exist. They cross back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, not just settlers, but people who travel to the Dead Sea.
Right.
And here in Jerusalem, it's the most obvious. You just go back and forth. There is no Green Line. Why is this an issue for Ir Amin?
Okay. So first, I think if in Jerusalem Israel's project was very successful in trying to erase the Green Line, I don't know if in the rest of the country it was as successful. Because there's a good amount of Israelis who, it doesn't even matter their political view, they don't go to settlements. It's not because they boycott the settlements or they're against the settlements. They don't feel safe in the settlements. They feel there's something else in the spirit there. If you're a Google engineer, yeah, living in Tel Aviv or Herzliya, you have nothing to look for in Ariel. And you're not going to move there because it's cheaper and you're not going to visit it as often. So if you're going to take the route, as you said, from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea every couple of years, okay, that might happen. But on an everyday reality, you're not going to Hebron. You're not going to go to the settlements around Nablus. It just doesn't happen. The main group who goes to settlements are people living in settlements. They don't have many jobs within the settlements. They have to go and travel to Israel to work. So the Green Line is very much felt in those areas. There's checkpoints, there's the wall. You feel when you pass it, and many people don't want to do it. They feel not safe. They feel it's not okay to be there, and they understand the two systems of laws. Jerusalem is a different story, though. And we would ask, I think, in the NGO, is the work of the Green Line, or erasing the Green Line in Jerusalem, is it supposed to do good for the civilians or for anyone living in Jerusalem or not? Is it for the sake of all Jerusalemites? Or is it done only to...
Jewish and Muslim.
Exactly. Jewish, Israeli, which are citizens, or Muslim and some Christians who are Palestinians and they're residents of Jerusalem. And as we see time after time, the whole idea of erasing the erosion of the Green Line in Jerusalem is only for the sake of Israel and for the Jewish civilians and for the Jewish population. Israel will never say, okay, we have an annexed city, we have a united city now, united, I say, with some cynicism as well. But we have a united city and we want to take care of everyone who lives here. If we will do so, we would also build Palestinian neighborhoods. But that was never done. From 67 till today, you have here, 11 Israeli neighborhoods, the one that we see on the map, and you have zero new Palestinian neighborhoods. So I think many years the idea was that, you know, we're keeping some of the status quo of Jerusalem, and maybe one day the eastern part will become Palestinian. Once again, I don't know if it will happen, but the idea of making a change on the ground will never be in favor of the Palestinians. If Israel building a neighborhood right here, Givat HaMatos, it's not building it for Palestinians that don't have a place to live in Beit Safafa, that can't build legally in Sur Bahre. It builds it on Palestinian land that was expropriated from individuals, and it's building it to ensure Jewish existence and majority in the city. So we never see a use of the Green Line in favor of the Palestinians. It's always, always in favor of the Israelis. What Israel is doing time after time is to make sure that any resource that could be used in Jerusalem is going to the hands of Jewish Israelis and the Palestinians. Perhaps one day they will give up, they will move out of the city, but that also has a price. If a Palestinian moves out of the city walls of Jerusalem, of the borders of Jerusalem, since they are not citizens of Israel, then they lose the residency. Yeah. So on one level, Israel is trying to perhaps despair the Palestinians who can't build a home near Gilo, although Gilo is being built. But Beit Safafa doesn't have a place to be built, and Walaje obviously never had a master plan. So they'll move to the West Bank, so outside of city lines of Jerusalem. Once Israel knows about it, they lose the residency. So the number of Palestinians in Jerusalem will decrease. But that plan didn't work. Yes, 15,000 to 20,000 lost their residency, which is a horrible story. But the Palestinians in Jerusalem, they understand that leaving the city is going to cost them their residency, which is their freedom to travel, which is social security, to medical care, to seeing your family, to jobs that are here. So they stay. And the people who actually...
And their attachment to Jerusalem as the cultural capital, cultural, spiritual capital of
Palestinians. Definitely. That's number one. I'm talking about more of the logistics one, but you're absolutely right. But the Israelis were actually the one who left, because the way Jerusalem built didn't make any sense. Why build Gilo when you didn't have population that needed to be here? And what Israel did throughout those years is to attract a more poor and more religious Israeli crowd that made others leave the city. So if Israel had some, you know, bohemian life in the 1970s, that started, that group left the city. And for many years, we saw a decrease in the Jewish population of Jerusalem. And the Palestinians stayed because, well, if they go, they lose everything they have.
And they love Jerusalem.
And they love Jerusalem and their connection to the city. So the Palestinians rose from 25% population in Jerusalem on the day of annexation to 40%. Israel sees it as a huge failure. All of the projects and all of the Judification that Jerusalem is trying to, that Israel is trying to do in the city, on some level they failed. And the place where they failed the most was the area around the old city. Because in that area, what we call the historic basin of Jerusalem, you have about 130,000 Palestinians and you have about 7,000 Jews, which is what? Less than 5% of the population
Wadi
in that
Al-Jos,
area.
Sheikh Jarrah,
exactly.
So, Silwan, Ras Al-Amud.
Exactly, Mount of Olives from the east of the old city.
Issawiya,
a bit outside of that area, but let's say the area that was pretty much aligned with Jordanian Jerusalem, that is very much Palestinian. And no matter what Israel did in the neighborhoods of the ring, so Ramot and Neve Yaakov and Pisgat Ze'ev and even Gilo, it never got to have a good hold of the areas around the old city, of the historic basin. That's why in the last couple of years, the battle is over these neighborhoods, and Israel is fighting so hard with any tool it has in order to take that land. Usually it comes in expense of Palestinians. Because here in Gilo, what Israel could do was expropriate private land and then to build a neighborhood on it. That means there were open areas.
Expropriate private Palestinian land.
Yes, definitely. But here, in such a crowded area, Israel cannot do it. And if you want to move Israeli Jews to the areas of the historic basin around the old city, it has to come on the expense of Palestinians. And that's how we hear of evictions and expulsions in Sheikh Jarrah and in Silwan. We're now on a Tuesday in late June. Tomorrow, the story of the Sumarin family is going to make it to the Supreme Court for perhaps our final hearing. And I would, you know, been supporting the family, and we hope they will stay in their home. But Israel claims that there is a law, and because of that law, they can't live there. The law is called absentee property. It means that if you own a home in Jerusalem, but you didn't live in that home because you're in the West Bank, then the home doesn't belong to you.
This is Sheikh Jarrah.
This is a similar story to what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah. But in
the Sumarin family.
Sumarin in Silwan.
In Silwan.
Okay. Sumarin, not only in Silwan. Sumarin lives exactly 30 seconds walk from the main entrance of City of David, which is a national park given to a political NGO called El-Ad, acronym of El Ir David, to the City of David. So that's, super central location, and Israel wants the home. So claims that Musa Sumarin, who lived in the home, he was absentee. He wasn't in Jerusalem. And the family managed to prove that he was there all alone. But they managed to prove it when he died. And then Israel told them, he was all along in the house, so he's not absentee. Okay, we understand. But he died now. Who are the people who inherit the home? Are they Jerusalem residents? And if they're not, then the home doesn't belong to you. It belongs to Israel. Israel can expropriate the home. And you know what? Let's say that already happened. But Israel, time after time, will choose to hand out this home to the same NGO that's working very hard, or associations working very hard, in order to push Palestinians out and evict them from their homes and to bring Jewish Israelis instead. That's the story of Silwan. My name is Shai Goren. I work as a guide in the public department of Ir Amim, an NGO that sees Jerusalem as the home and capital of both Israelis and Palestinians who live here. We're right now driving through a neighborhood called Silwan, which is one of the biggest neighborhoods. Marhaba, salam alaikum. one of the biggest neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. About 50,000 Palestinians live here. But what we're also seeing is a change that is done in the neighborhood by Jewish settler organizations, one of them known as Ateret Kohanim. What Ateret Kohanim is trying to do in a specific neighborhood that we're looking at called Batan El Hawa is to take custody of homes where Jews used to live up until 1948. So we need to understand that up until 48, up until the war, Jerusalem is a mixed city. We have some Jews living in the eastern part, with many Palestinians living in the western part. And in some neighborhoods, we just see a mix. In this one, we had Jewish Yemenites who lived in Batan El Hawa amongst their Palestinian neighbors, who, by the way, saved their lives. In 1929, when there was riots in Jerusalem and other Palestinians came over to attack Jews, the Palestinian residents of Silwan saved the life of the Jews in their village, and the Jews thanked them with a very famous letter that was done. But those homes were okay. Those homes were deserted already before 1938. The British told those Yemenite Jews they can't protect them and they have to leave. And that story remained up until the year 2003. So about 70 years or 60 years, we had Palestinians who took those homes and paid money, actually, to stay in those homes. In the year 2003 came a right-wing settler organization that the whole purpose of them is to bring Jews living on expense of Palestinians in East Jerusalem. They went to the Ministry of Justice in Israel and they said, well, the Jewish Yemenites used to live here under an endowment. And since there's no one who's responsible of the endowment, then us, Ateret Kohanim, are volunteering to be the custodian of the endowment. And that was it. By one signature of the Ministry of Justice in Israel, 100 homes were given to a Jewish organization that their all purpose is to kick Palestinians out of their homes. In the last 20 years, they've been working very hard in order to do so.
And those homes were, the Palestinians were evicted from those homes?
Yeah, we had 13 Palestinians to be evicted from these homes. And we have other over 80 families. So there's a couple of hundred individuals, many children, hundreds of kids within these homes who are now under the danger and threat of eviction. And once they will be evicted, then these homes will be taken by Jews. And I want to add to that, I don't think if it was the kids of the Yemenite Jews who lived there, the story would be a whole lot better. But the people who are now taking these homes, they have absolute no connection to the original owners before 1948.
And some of them are like Americans.
Some of them are Americans. Some of them are settlers that just need a place to live and they want a place for cheap. And when you have donations with hundreds of millions of dollars given by Jews like Irvin Moskovich, was the main donor for Ateret Kohanim, then you don't even have to ask rent from the locals who come to take the homes. You can either give it for free or to ask for a couple of hundreds of shekels a month. And those people who go in are going not just because of Ateret Kohanim, they go because of the connection of the right-wing NGO, the settler NGOs, and between the state of Israel. The Israeli government is the master plan of all of what's happening here. Because once a settler moves in, they get private security that is paid by Israel. The Ministry of Housing in Israel invests 3,000 shekels, which is roughly $1,000 a month, for the private protection of a single settler in this neighborhood. Without that, they won't live here. Israel is invested, and Israel want to make sure that they live here. Israel is on top of all of that, just holding hands together with settler organizations like Ateret Kohanim, that has managed to move, as I said, about 100 Jews to the neighborhood. In the same time, the settlers managed to buy an apartment or an apartment building from Palestinians. Palestinians built it, and then they sold it to settlers. They found a Palestinian who was willing to do so. The story has the building has seven floors, and it should be demolished. It's built without a permit. If it was owned still by Palestinians, it would be demolished tomorrow. Israel demolishes 250 apartments a year, some that have multiple families. But Israel doesn't touch the building in which the settlers live, called Bet Yehonatan, named after Jonathan Pollard, the Israeli spy in the States.
So and Beit Yonatan is over there?
Just in front of us, post some of the buildings that we can see.
And we see the Israeli flag.
And we're seeing an Israeli flag, not on Beit Yonatan, but also there. The Palestinians who see what is happening, they started the graffiti project, which is called I, as in I, my eye. So I witness Silwan, saying, we're seeing what you're doing to us. We're seeing the discriminatory act that you have. Now, I have to say on a personal note, If Israel want to open up the files before 1948, go ahead, open up the files. If you have ownership of land before 1948, allow people to go back to their homes. But not only Jews in East Jerusalem. Allow Palestinians to go back to their homes in West Jerusalem, in Jaffa, in Haifa. There were 800,000 Palestinians who became refugees in 1948. They can't go back to their homes because Israel had a different law called the absentee property law that determines that that's it. They lost their homes already in the year 1950. But the second law that was legislated after the annexation of Jerusalem, called administrative order from 1970, claims that if you left belongings here in Jordanian Jerusalem, meaning if you're Jewish Israeli, you can retrieve your belongings. There's one law that enables Jews to go back to their homes and for that would evict the Palestinians. There's another law that stops the Palestinians from getting their original homes.
Now, what are the conditions for Palestinians of Silwan who are living all around these little Jewish settlement outposts within really, really densely crowded Silwan?
Right. So,
what's it like for a Palestinian living right next to one of these little Jewish outposts?
I'll tell you what. First of all, life of Palestinians in Jerusalem is not easy because you're living without a master plan. And municipality doesn't go and not clean the street, doesn't give you connection to sewage many times. We talked about electricity cuts that are here. But the people who live in this part of Silwan called Batan El Hawa, they live even more terrible scenario because there are settlers in their neighborhoods that has private security. That's not even Israeli police that officially, you know, is a body that you can go and file a complaint if they do something wrong. Not that anybody will care about that complaint, but at least officially. Here is a private security system that can also attack those Palestinians. And we heard of multiple cases that Palestinians in the neighborhood are attacked. We work closely in Iramim with one individual from the neighborhood, who's the speaker of Batan El Hawa, called Zohir Rajmi. His family was beaten multiple times by settlers, by the private security itself.
So just walking down the street,
just walking down the street. Listen, if a settler want to leave their home, they're escorted by two security guards. Doesn't mean that every time they leave home there will be an attack, but it means that if a Palestinian in that area is looking at them and the security thinks that that Palestinian is no good, then they might go and attack him or talk to him in a certain way. And the police is, we know on which side they're on. So Zohir, our friend, he put security cameras around his house just to try to stop those attacks or to have any kind of evidence once they happen. Now, listen, I'll also tell you that there are Palestinians who attack Jewish Israelis. That happened. Yeah, I don't think we shouldn't discuss it. But when that happens, the authorities look at it in a completely different way. It's not that we have two sides here who are in a dispute. We have the Israelis who come over and bring their own people because they want them to take the neighborhood on the expense of Palestinians. And if there is violence in the neighborhood, Israel takes one side. That's how it works.
Shai Goren is a Jewish Israeli teacher and tour guide with the group Ir Amin. We'll link to Ir Amin's website and post more details about the situation in occupied East Jerusalem and the Palestinian West Bank at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions, Breda, in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. And please support independent Earth journalism. Subscribe to the GPM at greenplanetmonitor.net. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.